This is NPR News. I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. This hour, we're going to talk about parenting and the fears and anxieties that go with it these days. I've got two kids, and I've been reading parenting guides since they were infants, worrying that I was messing their lives up from day one. Were they sleeping enough? Am I causing them to have food allergies? Why aren't they reading yet? They're already 4 years old. And of course, when we're in public, where are they? They always seem to be out of my sight. Parenting these days can be a stressful mix of parent shaming, conflicting advice, and stress. This morning, I'm joined by two parenting experts to talk about raising kids and the fears and pressures involved. Catherine Reynolds-Lewis is the author of The Good News About Bad Behavior, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. And Dr. Bobbi Wegner is a clinical psychologist, and she joins us from Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Wegner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's not make this session just about me and my anxieties. Call in 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. What pressure do you feel as a parent? Have you ever experienced parent shaming? Have you found a way to manage your fears? 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Catherine, why don't I start with you? Why does parenting seem so different now than it was in the 70s, 80s, even 90s? What's changed?
Well, this is the question I started with when I began my reporting for this book 6 years ago. I noticed that kids seemed a lot more chaotic, disobedient. They had anxieties or attention problems. And I needed to understand if this was just my own anecdotal observation or something that was more widespread. So I looked at all the research, I talked to hundreds of parents, educators, and psychologists, and I came to the conclusion that kids are fundamentally different now. They have more difficulty managing their emotions, behavior, and thoughts, and so that just makes parenting harder.
Why is that the case? Why do you think, what's changed? We're genetically going through some kind of a global climate change, but with kids' emotions?
Right. Well, it's hard to prove. There could be some environmental factor that we just don't know about. But if you look at the big changes in our society in the last generation or two, there are three that are linked with an increase in anxiety, depression, and attention problems that I think are significant. Number one, childhood play has almost disappeared. Kids are supervised from the moment they wake up until they fall into bed at night. Number two is the growth in media and technology and social media, which can be correlated to anxiety and depression. And the third is that childhood has become about achievement instead of contribution. Kids are in some ways unemployed. They don't have a way to contribute to the home through household chores or through an after-school job, contribute to the community. And instead, they're asked to do these very high-powered things like be the athletic superstar or a gifted musician or straight-A student. And all of those are very demanding things that are also very focused on themselves. They don't have a way to see how their actions are improving the lives of the people who matter to them most.
Bobbi, does this ring true to you? Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think this is a lot of what I see in my clinical practice. And I would also add the pressure of social media, both on the child end and the parent end, are creating a sense of insecurity, I think, and anxiety, which is adding to this as well.
Oscar in Bloomington is already on the line. Let's get right to the phone calls. Oscar, what did you want to talk about?
Well, I was just wondering, if I'm a little too overprotective of my son, I limit his sugar intake and the screen time he has on technology. I was wondering if I'm a little excessive with it. I only give him about an hour a day, maybe two if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm. Bobbi, what do you think? Is there being too overprotective and limiting sugar and cutting off screen times? I think about this often because my kids have, like Oscar's kids, have limited screen time, and I wonder, are they missing out on pop culture and references that other kids have?
Right. I think it's very dependent. Oscar, did you say how old your kids are?
Is Oscar still there?
Oh, sorry.
He's going to be three.
3? He's going to be 3. Okay. So that, you know, he's still very young. So I think cutting back on sugar and having limited screen time seems developmentally appropriate. And I think these norms and kind of expectations change over time and grow with the child, too. So it's kind of a hard thing to answer just without knowing much about Oscar and his child and his parenting style. But obviously, it's really important to have some boundaries and structure and expectations for every family, and that it can be very, healthy for children.
Catherine, what do you think? Do you think that there is, how do you find that balance between making sure your kids are protected, but letting them have that time like we used to have in the 70s, 80s, when we just kind of sit around and I'd watch Batman on TV for hours at a time and eat giant bowls of ice cream and then wander around in the woods behind my house.
Right. It's definitely a balance. And for me, it's helpful to see it as a dynamic situation. When your baby's born, you're in charge of everything and you're responsible for everything. When they are 18, we hope they will leave the home, be independent and successful without you at all. So between that 0 to 18, you're constantly going to be expanding the range of things that they're responsible for and shrinking what you're responsible for. And our role is really to prepare them, not to control them. So for very young children, yes, absolutely, we need to limit sugar, unhealthy foods, screen time. We want to focus on increasing their ability to access the outdoors, to learn how to play independently, to go longer and longer times without us. And depending on your circumstance, that may mean playing outdoors. It may mean playing with other groups of kids. But the more that they're able to take charge of their lives and make those decisions, they will start to feel the consequence of eating a huge bowl of sugared cereal. Maybe they don't feel so great, you know? And we're going to be the ones who are helping them to make those connections and to understand the impact of their decisions. So as we let them make more decisions on their own, we're also going to need to play that important role of helping them really understand and recognize the implications of the choices that they make.
Let's go to the phones again. Julie in Alexandria, Minnesota. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
What's your story and how old are your kids?
Well, I have a 3.5-year-old and 2-year-old, and I find I struggle most with my oldest, well, both of them actually. If I ask them to do something, they don't listen. So I'll repeat myself and say, I'm going to count to 3. You can do it or I can help you do it. And they still won't listen. And then I'll yell loudly and almost have anger in my voice after I've repeated myself 5 times. And the only way to get them to comply is when I go into that loud, angry space. And then my oldest will say, Mom, why do you yell so much? Why are you so mad? And it's just constant. I always have to repeat myself multiple times, and they won't listen until I get to that yelling point.
I really feel for you, Julie, when my children point out to me, like, why are you yelling? Or they say, Mom, they talk to me very softly. They're 10 and 12. They say, Mom, you seem really stressed out right now. Bobby, what advice do you have for Julie?
I want to ask yourself, Julie, in part, you know, obviously this is a more complicated question, but what are you asking and how often are you asking? So, you know, kind of, is this a general problem or is this a more specific thing? And really, it's like, parents sometimes get in the trap of almost kind of parental nagging in some way, and I'm not making the assumption that that's what you're doing, but kids end up sometimes tuning out when that is the case. And I think that can also be a product a little bit of our current parenting culture when we're on our kids for every little thing and every moment. And so I often help parents, like, look at their own family dynamic, look for areas where they can find opportunity to back off and give their kid more freedom and space. But then when they do ask their child to do something or set a limit, to be very clear that that's expected and there's going to be either a consequence or if that's not really followed or adhered to.
Catherine, do you have any advice for when you just feel like you need to yell and that's the only way you can get through?
Yes. So in the research for my book, I found some pretty alarming connections between yelling, verbal, extreme verbal correction and mental illness. So obviously not every kid who's yelled at develops mental illness, but it can make them more susceptible. And it also harms your relationship. And I'm guessing that's why Julie feels uncomfortable with the situation, because she doesn't want to yell. And what I would advise is, first of all, train your children that you're only going to say something once. So instead of calling to them across the room, you want to go up close, make sure you're eye to eye, and they actually are paying attention. So often we think they hear us, but they're in their own little worlds. And there's something that I like to use that I wrote about in the book called an interruption signal, where you put a hand on their arm and you let them know that means that you need their attention, and you wait until they look at you and make eye contact to give your instruction. And that way, you both know that there's a communication and you only have to say it once. They can also use that interruption signal with you if they want your attention instead of nagging or whining. And the great thing about that is that you're going to retrain them instead that you're going to talk and say things 3 or 4 times and then yell. You only say it once, and that's the chance that they get. The other thing I would say is to let routines be the guide instead of you. So have a family routine for mornings, after preschool, evenings. You can post on the wall. They can help you to color or take pictures or cut out pictures from magazines so that they know the routines. And you as the parent only need to look or point to the routine for them to know what they need to do. It's sort of taking a page from the preschool teacher's attitude of everyone in that class knows what to do. They hang up their coats on the hook by the door. They put their shoes away. And we want to cultivate that same kind of independence and responsibility, even in our 2- and 3-year-olds, because they're very able to clean up after themselves as a matter of habit instead of having to be told.
Nina in Minneapolis is on the line right now. Hi, Nina. What was your question or comment? Good.
Yeah, I'm pretty good. It's more a comment or a question. I really want you to elaborate a little bit on how a cultural and race and socioeconomic background has a difference on raising a child and how that can impact the social-emotional learning on a young person.
Bobby, do you think you can take this one?
Sure. I mean, I think that's a very important question. So in my practice, I'm, you know, as I just sort of noted, that I'm always trying to help parents find ways to give their kids more freedom and independence and those opportunities to explore and to go out in their neighborhoods alone at different ages. And obviously that is very dependent on where you live and what your neighborhood is. So, you know, kids growing up in more privileged, typically white neighborhoods have more opportunity to potentially do that than someone who's growing up in a neighborhood that has more socioeconomic disadvantage that might not necessarily be as safe. So it really has to be put into context, right? And there are different ways that it's important for all children to feel secure in their relationship with their parents, to feel safe, and to have opportunities for creativity, for play, for independence and exploration. But, you know, to your point, that really has to be tailored to, you know, what families can offer and what neighborhoods can offer and kind of the sociocultural position they're placed in the world.
Catherine, did you have anything to add to this? I feel like sometimes when we talk about parenting, we just default to people who are middle class, white. I read a lot about parenting advice, and there are mothers with 2-year-olds who are 45. You know, they're very well off. They've got a 2-parent household, and they have almost the luxury to worry. What advice do you have for people who don't come from a really wealthy background or have a 2-parent household?
So in my book, I looked at 4 models of discipline across the country in all different kinds of communities and families. And I tried to pull out from the successful models of disciplining kids the things that worked. And in all of those different settings, the 3 elements that were the same were connection between an adult and child, communication about the child's behavior or actions, and a focus on capability building. So you're always increasing the child's skills and independence. And that may mean something different in a different community. But in every setting, adults are able to build kids' social and emotional skills, to improve their life skills. And it was really remarkable to me. One of the models I looked at is called the Boston Basics, which is focused on 0 to 3 in high poverty, high trauma, at-risk communities, and they're really focusing on the very basic things that parents can do to build a solid connection between the adult and child, because that's the most important thing that our kids need for resilience, is to know that there is a responsive adult who loves and cares for them. So just as every child is born with their unique temperament, and we as the parent have to understand and help them make the most of that temperament, we also need to look at our own circumstances in our homes and our communities and how our own situation's going to influence the way that we parent. And going back to the beginning of this conversation, you know, we need to, as parents, have the confidence that we are doing what's right for our kids based on who they are and who we are and our circumstances, and not get into the second guessing and being shamed for our decisions.
Let's go to the phones right now. Tiffany is in St. Louis Park, and she is a brand new mother. Congratulations, Tiffany. Hi, Tiffany, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi. Congratulations on the newborn. 2 months old, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
I think you might need to turn on the radio in the background, and then you'll be able to hear us better. And you had a question or a comment, right?
Yeah, more of a comment, I guess. And it was about, you touched on at the beginning about the pressure that moms feel from social media. So for myself, I think the normal fears that every new mom fears about car seat safety and sleeping at night, and I think it's just kind of exacerbated by, you've seen, I haven't been mom shamed, but I've seen it time and time again where a mom will post a picture of their child in the car, like singing a cute song, and then you see hundreds of people commenting about the car seat's not on correctly, that's not safe, and just things like that. So I think it'd be interesting to hear more about the pressures that parents face now, just versus the fears that everyone faces about car seats and sleeping. And I think it's just amplified through social media.
Great. Thank you so much, Tiffany. And Khadijah had something similar. She had called in and she says that she's anxious because of other parents and she gets way too much feedback from her friends and family. She says people in our generation have very high expectations. Bobby, how do you manage the expectations of others and take advice from people, but also know when you just need to ignore it also?
You know, I think that's really hard for new parents in particular, but all parents, you know, none of us have a child and have previous experience, right? This is kind of like the great equalizer in many ways, even despite, you know, being a psychologist and having worked with children and families and nannied when I was younger. It's just like having a kid changes it. And, you know, you don't know what you're doing until you're really into it. And I have experienced that from my first, you know, I have three children, from my firsthand experience and through parents that I work with. So I think this idea of sort of uncertainty and fear and anxiety is just so common with parents. I think when people have kids, there's this natural kind of chaos and feeling of not knowing that comes along with having a new baby. And I think we're all working to find the right way. And with that, when you feel a little insecure or anxious, people become very black and white in their thinking. And a lot of it, you sometimes end up judging other people, thinking like, you know, if they're doing something different, then either I'm doing something wrong or they're doing something wrong. So I think this is where a lot of the parent shaming comes up for people. But at the end of the day, there's many different ways to do this, and there are many different approaches that work. And I think it's really about getting clear about what works for you and what works in your family. And also knowing that this is going to change over time. You know, this is really the biggest experiment of like trial and error, right? Like you live and learn and you talk to friends. And I find the parents with older children that have gone through it before are the best resource for me and for other parents often. And just to adjust as you go and try not to beat up on yourself.
Catherine?
Or beat up on others.
Yeah, and beat up on others. It's true. Catherine, do you have any advice for people who are, especially people with brand new children who are exhausted and stressed out and maybe still trying to balance work and family, and they just need and they feel pressure from social media?
Yes. So I love what Bobby suggested. I think that's a great place to start of just, getting some perspective, getting out of the echo chamber of people who are all the same stage of life as you, which is great. You can get lots of relevant advice, but you also are hearing from people who maybe aren't so sure of their own choices, so they need to judge you or, be the know-it-all. So get some perspective from other parents, and most of all, care for yourself. So instead of scrolling through Instagram for another half hour, go to sleep. Get yourself whole first. So when we're talking about teaching kids to manage their emotions or manage their fears and anxieties, we need to do that first. So in order for us to be our best selves for our kids, that means we have to be able to manage those little anxieties and fears, and getting sleep, getting exercise, having a go-to menu of things that we know are going to make us feel better, that's where we start. And then we can teach them to our kids, obviously not at 2 months, but as they get older, have them say, oh yeah, you're feeling anxious or you're feeling unhappy. Sometimes I go out for a run when I feel unhappy, or I try to look for something good to do for someone else so that they can start to experiment and find the things that help them to manage their fears and emotions. I think that we need to also just pay attention. If there are friends who are always putting snarky comments in your social media feeds, I'm sorry, block them, right? Why do you need to be around people like that? So for relatives, it may be harder, but you can always just say thanks to a snarky comment and then move on and maybe hide their comments from now on.
We're talking about parenting fears and anxiety. Do you struggle with parenting anxiety? Why? And what are your strategies for coping with parenting fear? Give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. I've got two guests with me. Dr. Bobby Wegner is a clinical psychologist from Boston, and Catherine Reynolds Lewis is the author of The Good News About Bad Behavior. Mike from Minneapolis called. He said, what about the extended family and the historic role in raising kids? In today's current environment and cultural context, it's so much harder to raise kids. There's not as much help from extended family. And I'd like to give a shout out right now. My parents have my kid. He's got pink eye. He's with them. And I think he's going to go out and see the movie Alpha with his grandpa. And I'm lucky and grateful that they are around to help me raise them. Does that add to stress, the feeling that you don't have anyone you can turn to, Bobby?
Oh, absolutely. I know. A shout out to my father-in-law, too, who's at home manning my three kids right now. And he's covering for our nanny. But I think that that's exactly right. There's, as our culture has become more and more isolated, people feel more and more alone and more and more both anxious and ashamed. So these, when you're in a larger group or a larger tribe or a village, or you get feedback from mothers, grandmothers, other people who are there to both support you and kind of teach you what they have known, what they've known to work. And I think, when we are alone at home and just trying to keep our heads above water, you don't really have that support if you don't have close family members around to help out. And I think that's why it's really important for parents to find their own tribe in some way, or create a sense of community, even though it might not be family. But it's really, really important, especially for new parents, to find that community early on to give some of that social emotional support.
We're going to take a brief break for some news. And when we come back, I'm going to talk to Catherine Reynolds Lewis and Dr. Bobby Wegner more. And Catherine, I think I'll come to you and ask you about how to build that kind of community or that tribe. But right now, let's head to Stephen John. Hi, Stephen. What's in the news?
Stephanie, responding to criticism from President Donald Trump, Google says its search is not used to set a political agenda and the results are not biased toward any political ideology. Google said that when users search for content, quote, our goal is to make sure they receive the most relevant answers in a matter of seconds, and they never rank search results to manipulate political sentiment. Trump said today Google's search engine was hiding fair media coverage of him. Three Republicans are vying today to replace Arizona's junior Senator Jeff Flake. He's retiring after fierce criticism of President Trump made his political future in the state untenable. The race comes 3 days after the state's senior senator, John McCain, died of brain cancer. Florida and Oklahoma are also holding elections today. As for the now empty McCain seat, Arizona's Republican governor says he won't be naming a replacement until after the senator's burial next Sunday. Americans' consumer confidence rose in August to the highest level in nearly 18 years as their assessment of current conditions improved further and their expectations about the future rebounded. That's according to the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index. Consumers' confidence is in their ability to get a job and the overall economy are seen as important indicators of how freely they will spend, especially on big-ticket items such as cars in coming months. Consumer spending accounts for 70% of economic activity in the U.S. On Wall Street, stocks are little changed after setting records over the past few days. The Dow is up about 15 points in midday trading. Cloudy for Minnesota, continued chance of showers until late this afternoon. Cooler, highs around 60 in the north, upper 60s to mid-70s in the south. Time now, 11:32.
Programming supported by CenterPoint Energy's Home Service Plus, serving Minnesota for over 80 years. Their professionals are committed to helping you repair, replace, and maintain your hardworking appliances. Learn more at centerpointenergy.com/HSP.
On the next NPR News Presents, marking the 50th anniversary of Hubert Humphrey's nomination for president and 70 years since his Democratic National Convention speech about human rights, the documentary The Politics of Joy, today at noon and 9 p.m.
Support comes from the Nobel Peace Prize Forum, September 14th and 15th, hosted by Augsburg University. Speakers include Nobel laureates and other global leaders in peace and conflict resolution. Learn more at peace.augsburg.edu.
I'm Stephanie Curtis. This is NPR News. I'm joined by Dr. Bobby Wegner, a clinical psychologist, and Catherine Reynolds Lewis, the author of The Good News About Bad Behavior. We're talking about parenting and stress and fears and anxieties and how to manage them. Let's go right to the phones, actually, because we've got a lot of people on the line right now. Rachel in Minneapolis. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just calling. I have three kids, a 6-year-old, 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. And I've learned a lot just in these short years with my kids. But one of the things that I have definitely become more aware of after having my third kiddo is that one place that I think a lot of parents can experience a lot of shaming and anxiety is actually like at the park, for example. As a parent, I like to let my kids explore and check things out. You know, we live in Minneapolis, so there aren't a ton of opportunities around our house to be able to get out, but I love it when we can go to the park and they can explore. And I remember one particular time my 3-year-old was climbing around on the park and is pretty good on his feet. And I had a parent come up and just say something along the lines of, wow, he's really climbing a lot. And I said, yeah, yep, he really enjoys doing that and checking things out. And she said, well, you're standing over here watching him, so if he were to fall, it's not like you could help him. Ooh. And I was so struck by that comment because, of course, I would help him. I would come over and comfort him if he got hurt or fell, but I also want to give him the freedom to explore and check things out in a safe way. And so I was really kind of taken aback by just that judgment in her tone of voice and kind of disappointed that people feel that way and think that way and kind of want to put other parents down. It's too bad. So I appreciate this discussion today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in, Rachel. And I don't know how anyone could defy physics and manage to grab reach their child before they hit the ground, even if they were close. I'm not sure what people expect from parents. Catherine, what did you think of Rachel's comment?
Well, I would just say kudos to Rachel because you're doing exactly the right thing that our children need is more opportunities to fall and to discover, oh, I didn't break. And that's how children learn resilience and confidence. It's not by having a mom who's always standing underneath them saying, be careful, or saying, I'll catch you if you fall. In fact, one of the studies I looked at for my book looked at people who had a fear of heights as adults, and then looked at their childhood experiences to see if there was any connection. And instead of seeing that people who fell had a fear of heights later, they found the opposite relationship. So children who fell from a height were less likely to have a fear of heights as an adult. And we're so afraid of all these things, our kids getting hurt, our kids getting kidnapped, our kids being unsafe in a car. And yet the number one danger to our kids is their mental health. So in my book, I write about this one study from the National Institutes of Health that found 1 in 2 children by the time they're 18 will have a mood or behavioral disorder or a substance addiction. That's what we really should be trying to protect our kids against. And the way to do that is to build their resilience, to let them have experiences. And for that situation at the park, I've heard it many times from other parents, so you're not alone. And what I sometimes tell people to do is when you first get to the park, see if you can make a couple small connections with other parents there so that you have some goodwill before anything happens or before someone decides to get judgmental. Because even just saying, hey, I'm Rachel, my kid is 3, and what about you? That can form a little bit of a basis for connection that makes people less likely to then get judgy on you.
Bobby, did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm thinking, first off, Rachel, you're totally the mom that I would want to be friends with at the playground if there's any consolation. And there, not only is your parenting style benefiting your child, it actually has a kind of a greater good or greater benefit to the current culture of parenting. Because a lot of parents are parenting out of kind of fear that somebody is going to either judge or, you know, worst case scenario, call the police or something and suggest that they're being negligent or something. And so parents end up following their kids around the playground, which is such an American style of parenting. If you go to other European cultures, the parents don't do that. They sit on the bench and have a coffee and chat and, you know, kind of allow their children to explore and play. And so by sitting back and letting your kid play, you're actually giving other parents permission to do the same. And I just think that's great. And it's the way, you know, the direction we need to move as a culture. And we're just doing a disservice to our kids right now by following them around.
Our number is 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Anne in Duluth called. Hi, Anne. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
What did you want to talk about?
Well, I have older kids. My oldest is 26, and when he was 9, he was diagnosed with what was then called Asperger's syndrome. Mm-hmm. So he had been on the spectrum since he was born, and we didn't know what was up with him. And so I would try to make him, like you suggested, look at me when I wanted him to listen. But my son couldn't look at me and listen at the same time. And I'm listening to a lot of younger parents, you know, new parents. And my little bit of advice about what I would change if I could go back and do it again is to pay more attention to my individual son and a little less attention to the parenting books and experts that I was listening to and reading about and trying to impose discipline on him. My second child was pretty neurotypical, and I pretty much never needed to discipline her at all. Mm-hmm. But my first son, I think I'm still learning from him, and now he's, you know, much more articulate. He understands himself. He's really a great kid, and I just wish I would have listened to him more individually, because he wasn't. The same kind of discipline was not going to work with them. The same kind of connections, all the different things that were in vogue at that time, you know, 1, 2, 3 or whatever. Look at me when I'm talking to you. None of that was appropriate for him. And so, I mean, I think he turned out okay.
Good.
But I would have just individualized I think the most important thing that I've heard on the conversation is to prioritize your relationship mm-hmm. with your own child.
Okay.
So I think that's, if you got that down, the rest will fall into place.
Thank you so much, Anne. Thanks for calling in. Catherine, what did you hear there?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, Anne, it sounds like you really do understand and support your child. So don't beat yourself up for not getting there sooner. We all have our own path, and we're making mistakes and learning just as our kids are. So we can't expect to be perfect. And in fact, them seeing us struggle to figure something out and then succeed and be persistent, that is a good model as well. So I agree 100% that the number one thing we need to do is to understand our own child's temperament, their challenges, their special abilities, so that they can see them in a positive light and learn the kind of strategies they're going to need to succeed in life. And instead of maybe trying to push our shy child to be more outgoing or pushing them into situations that they're not ready for, to help them to understand, you know, what is it about that makes them feel shy, and how can they learned what they need to be really successful and to thrive and feel good about themselves. I actually got into the reporting for my book from a perspective of looking at kids with special needs because they're much more likely to be disciplined in school disproportionately to their any kind of behavior that they might exhibit. So that's a population that I think needs our support and understanding even more. And it sounds like you're doing a great job as a mom to your 26-year-old.
Let's go to the phones. Valerie in Eden Prairie called, and I really liked your question, Valerie. What? Why don't you tell us what it is?
Hi. I'm wondering how we can show support to other parents who might be in a public place with children who are struggling emotionally. How can we lend them support, let them know that we support them?
That's a great question, Valerie. And I remember one time I was in Target with my daughter, and she was melting down. And we're in the checkout line, and the woman in front of me turned around and asked my daughter, could you help me unload my basket? And my daughter immediately went from yelling at me because I hadn't bought her a purple tracksuit to saying, yes, I can help. And it completely calmed my daughter down and really helped out. And I'm always grateful to that woman at Target, whoever you were. What else can you do if you see someone struggling with a child and maybe getting inappropriately angry with their child, Bobby?
You know, I think that's a really good tactic is offering like a point of distraction for the child. So you got to gauge the parent because you don't want to mess in an interaction that, you know, might be unwanted. But points of distraction are always great, like, oh, hey, I love your shoes or something that's going to move the kid from a more emotional state to a more cognitive thinking state, which is always helpful. And I think sometimes, you know, I think when a kid's melting down in Target or any public place, you know, you're trying to deal with your kid, but then a close second is that the parent often looks around to see who the child's disrupting or who's judging. Mm-hmm. And even just like the little smiles in those moments to the mom or the dad, like, yeah, I get it. You know, I'm not judging, or even asking, like, can I help in any way? I think that goes a long way for people. But, you know, it's just like sending the signal that you know that these emotional storms come and they go and nothing more needs to be made out of it.
Vincent from Pequot Lakes. Vincent, what did you want to talk about?
I'm
glad to have a man call in, by the way. Thank you for calling.
Oh, yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Perfect. Well, thank you for taking my call. I had a question regarding today's society and how phones and tablets are such a staple piece of technology and advancement. How mm-hmm. do we still allow children to have that wonder and go outside and play with sticks and throw rocks and have that fun outdoor experience, but not limit them and not have them held back by keeping them off of the tablet? What's the balance there?
Catherine, why don't you take that one? I just want to confess, yesterday I was judging somebody when I was walking through the grocery store. She had a 2-year-old who was sitting staring at a phone, and I thought that child shouldn't have a phone. And then I quickly took it back and thought, well, look, if that's getting them through this and they get out of the store and get on with their day, oh, you know, go with God. Get it done, woman. But what is the appropriate amount of phone versus outdoor playing with sticks time?
I think that I don't think you need to worry that your kids aren't going to get enough exposure to technology. They have it in schools. They have it eventually as they're in middle and high school. They're going to have plenty of access. They won't be left behind. So I think what I've advise parents to do and what I do myself with my 3 kids is to just talk about a healthy balance. So having outdoor time every day, having physical exercise every day, having connection with other human beings, even if it's just your family, but ideally other kids, and of course, some fun on the tablet and the phone. So it needs to just be a balance as opposed to thinking, okay, the phone and the technology is what we are prioritizing because it's going to have its own draw. I don't think you should worry about that.
Bobby?
Yeah, I think, you know, kids, once they get on the tablets, they're not going to stop on their own. So they need parents to step in there and say, you know, it's time to get off. Once the dopamine's flowing, they're just going to keep going until, you know, the night's over. So parents really do need to interject and say, okay, time to turn the tablets off. Let's go outside and do whatever and create some kind of free play. But I also think our society is swung the other way where there's this huge panic around any screen time, which is creating the secondary anxiety and stress for parents, like, oh my God, my kid's, you know, going to fail out of high school because they spend, my nine-year-old spends an hour or two on a playing Fortnite or something. So, you know, obviously it's not ideal, but I also think there's this idea of sort of good enough parenting. And in our culture, we have this expectation that we're supposed to do everything right 100%, and that sense of perfection changes with whatever guidelines have shifted. So it again comes back to, like, what works for your family and what works for your child, and, you know, really asking yourself, is your kid getting enough, you know, getting enough sleep in, enough exercise in, getting some healthy food in, but really going back to the basics here.
Kim in Edina has called. Hi, Kim. What did you want to talk about?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about stress and anxiety with parenting with regards to extended family. Mm-hmm. And in my case, I moved from my extended family up here to my husband's extended family. And at the time, our in-laws did not live here, but they did move here within a few years. And they had never lived with our kids. And I was really looking forward to having them being a part of my kids' life and our life and having them help and having them form relationships with my kids. And I was really disappointed because it never came to that. They just were not very hands-on grandparents. They weren't that interested in young kids, and they really did not offer to do much. And it created a big wedge between my husband and I because I couldn't convince him of my feelings and my hurt and my disappointment, and he just couldn't stand up to them and ask for their support and for help, and it made our relationship really difficult. So my advice to other people in this situation, if you don't know what your in-laws' capabilities are with grandparenting or being hands-on or whatever, just, I guess, try to lower your expectations and have none, and then hopefully if they do step up and offer any help or willingness to be a part of your kids' lives, just be happy for it, because it really devastated me, and it really made our marriage difficulties worse at the time. And I just felt so alone because I was up here without my family, who happened to be the opposite types, and they really were sad to see my kids move away, and they were very hands-on. So it was a difficult, stressful time. Mm.
I'm sorry to hear that, Kim. Thanks for calling in and sharing your experience. It was helpful to hear that. Catherine, we go into having children with expectations that, you know, it's going to be part of a lineage, and the grandparents will feel this way about them, when the aunts and uncles will weigh in and help support. How do you manage your expectations for your family? Like Kim ended up lowering them.
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, we all go into it thinking we're going to have a specific kind of kid, mm-hmm. and a specific kind of outcome, and life is going to throw curveballs. So it may be, you know, you have a child who's not neurotypical or has special needs, or, you know, your parents are older than they thought they were when it comes to helping take care of a demanding baby. So I think, you know, asking for help is important. We all feel so much pride in being independent. But in those early years when your kids are little, you know, as Kim said, you know, ask for help. And if it's not given, then try to just look elsewhere. And this is where we kind of come back to what we were talking about before with building that community of support, where you don't have to just rely on yourself and your partner or spouse, that you can turn to neighbors or friends or other people in the community. In our neighborhood, there are some, you know, older families who don't have kids at home anymore, and they love having a role in helping with our kids, and to know them and to be part of their lives. So wherever you can find it, you know, try to ask for help. We also started a babysitting co-op, so that was another wonderful way to lessen the load a little bit and build community at the same time.
Garrett from Sartell. Hi, Garrett.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for calling in. Do you have some advice?
We have a daughter that has a spinal muscular atrophy. It fits in with what you just spoke of. We had our certain plans that we wanted. We have four children, and it was our fourth child that exhibited spinal muscular atrophy symptoms. And it has actually really informed our parenting. You know, we think we're rowing the boat, and we are throwing that curveball, like you mentioned, and has actually informed how we parent our well-abled children as well, that low-risk failure teach us just as much as our successes, and there are obstacles in life that you just cannot accept, cannot help. And mm-hmm. Our goal is to build hopefully happy children, but most of all, children that can adapt well and still contribute.
Great. Thanks for the advice, Garrett. That was really great. Bobby, what did you hear and what Garrett was advising?
Yeah, I mean, Garrett, it sounds like your daughter is very lucky to have you as a dad, and I think that's just a great lesson to be shared. I think oftentimes when people have kids, there's a whole host of expectation that parents have that often they don't even realize, or that's more unconscious. And, you know, you have this kid that arrives in the world and you expect that they're going to play certain sports or be really good at one thing, or there's different expectations put on the child and the parents and the family and the community, like, automatically. And so it's one way I like to think about it is, imagine if a child just showed up in your door one day and you're really asked to be a mentor or a guide rather than, someone who is kind of like part of you in some way. Mm-hmm. And how would that shift your parenting? So if you're just trying to help this person be the best person they can be in the most successful way they can be, like, what is that? And it kind of allows parents to step back and think about what expectation that they're already kind of imposing on themselves and their child.
Catherine?
We all do it.
Yeah, we do. Catherine, what did you hear and what Garrett advised?
Oh, I love the idea of low-risk failures. Mm-hmm. And, sometimes people say, at the dinner table, we'll talk about what did you do that was good today. But sometimes parents might ask, what did you do that was hard, or what did you do that was scary or risky? And try to encourage your kids to take lots of small risks, low risks, and to learn from them, and to let them see us also struggle with a curveball that life threw us and overcome it, because none of us are going to have a perfectly smooth life. And for our children to expect that there will be obstacles and that they will have the skills and the ability to surmount them, that's the biggest gift we could give them.
Let's go to the phone calls. I want to talk to Wade from the Twin Cities before we go, because it's an important point about the fears we all have. Wade, what was your question or comment?
Yeah, so I'd like to thank everybody for their candor, that you two guests for showing that they're not perfect and they have the same issues that the listeners all have with target tantrums and everything. So I've got a 12-year-old son and two younger daughters, and we live in a suburb, which is just, a subdivision. You got one subdivision after another. I grew up in a small town where I could ride down to the drugstore and read the magazines, or there's a hardware and a toy store and things like that. You don't get that environment so much anymore. And rather than have him sit on his butt all day playing on his iPad or playing Fortnite, it's like, I want to get him out of the house, go see your buddies, do whatever. Well, he has to go through like a very safe crosswalk across a highway and then another one. And, his buddy's parents, oh, God, no way can they leave the neighborhood. No way could they go across the crosswalk. It's dangerous, And then there's the whole Jacob Wetterling effect of there's a pedophile and an abductor around every corner. Mm-hmm. If you let your kid out of your sight, you're going to lose him forever. And, it's kind of raising a whole generation of kids that just, they're just used to this airbag and safety harness around them all the time. And, what do you say to parents that just want their kids to get out and take a little risk? I mean, he's smart enough to know that when, the crosswalk says to cross, you can cross. Mm-hmm. there's a little element of social Darwinism that's going to take over,
Thanks for calling in, Wade. I appreciate that. And my son is 10, and he regularly walks to the comic book store near our house on Grand Avenue in St. Paul. It's called Mischief. It's this great store. And he walks there by himself, and sometimes with a friend or his sister, And we had one of his friends came over, and they were going to, my son said, let's go over to Mischief. And the other parent balked a little bit and said, oh, where did they go? I'm like, well, they just walk across the street. They go, you know, like, it's a couple blocks. It's a walk, and they walk into a busy shopping area. But I let them go, and my friend let her son go with my son also. And so they went out. But it was something that alarmed her to begin with. And when did this change come, Catherine? When did we become so fearful about kids just wandering a little?
Yeah, I think it was in the 80s and 90s when there was a sort of spate of fear about child abduction, the JonBenet Ramsey incident, and a playground safety also became a big issue where suddenly playgrounds all had to be padded and you couldn't fall. And it may be that it also coincided with more women entering the workforce and this idea that somehow our society was changing and our children were, you know, at risk. So I would like to applaud both you, Stephanie, and also Wade for being the change that we need in the world. And just let's all keep trying, because the more that other parents hear, yeah, I'd let my 10-year-old do that, or yeah, I'd let my 12-year-old do that, the more open they'll be to doing it themselves. And What are they thinking, that they're just going to wait until their kid's 18, until they can walk down the street? So at some point, our kids need to learn to do these basic, simple life skills. And I've heard so many stories, and a lot of them are in my book, about families that have managed to change the culture of their community just by persisting in a open-minded and flexible way to find those other like-minded families who are willing to let kids have more independence. And then when other families see that, and frankly, when the kids see it, they want to be part of that capable, independent group of kids who are more free.
All right, we're almost out of time, but I want to make sure we get Reba and Fargo on, because her advice looks astonishingly great. Reba, hello.
Hi.
Tell us your advice. I love this.
Well, I learned from a blog I read about a woman who realized she was never seeing her friend who lived in town, and they instituted a thing called crappy dinner. The whole point is for the parents to be able to spend time together without the pretense of having to do a lot of preparation. So we'll spontaneously say, I'm inviting you for crappy dinner tonight. And the rule is that you can't spend more than 15 minutes cleaning, and you can't go out and buy any groceries or make a special trip. So people know they can bring their own leftovers, or just whatever you have in the fridge is what you have. And it doesn't matter what your house looks like. The point is to have time together to build those relationships and support each other as parents.
Thank you so much, Reba. I love that advice. And I have family, I have friends, a couple groups of friends that when they come over, I do not clean my house for them. That it's just there. I know they're not going to judge me. I don't judge them. You walk in the door and you've got to crawl over the pile of shoes, and we're all okay with it. And I think that's great. Bobby, any last words of advice for people?
You know, I think it's to some of the caller's points, just looking for those opportunities for to give your kids more freedom, and to also notice those moments when you find yourself judging others, because the reality is we all do this and we all contribute to this in some way. And just kind of, I guess it all starts with ourselves first. Like, you know, can we look for moments to change what we're thinking about others, or changing those judging thoughts?
Thanks so much, Bobby. Bobby Wegner is a clinical psychologist. And Catherine Reynolds Lewis, thanks for joining us also. Catherine is the author of The Good News About Bad Behavior. You should pick up that book. Thank you for joining us, Catherine.
My pleasure.
If you want to keep this conversation going, be sure to check out the NPR News Facebook group that's just for parents. Now, this is a place for you to discuss like these fears, these anxieties, but also just ideas about weekend fun around Minnesota and other issues that we face. Beginning the school year, I bet there are a lot of people weighing in on how they're dealing with planning for that. Just search Raising Kids in Minnesota on Facebook. That's Raising Kids in Minnesota.